The following episode will contain references to stories and characters that may cause sudden and uncontrollable feelings of nostalgic joy and wonder. Listener discretion is advised.
You know who you are?
Steven is my name.
Even Steven.
Will you say something, Steven?
Steven or else media.
You're listening to another G.I. Joe podcast, and this is episode number 0. An incredibly long, brief history of G.I. Joe comics. Hello and welcome to another G.I. Joe podcast. The podcast that's reading G.I. Joe comics from the 80s and then talking about them one issue at a time. I'm your host, my name is Steven. And yeah, I know that there's like a crap ton of other G.I. Joe podcasts out there, and you know what? Frankly, I don't really care. Don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to be flippant or dismissive. And there is a lot of great work out there being done by other fans. For me, it isn't about competition or stepping on toes. For me, it's pretty simple. G.I. Joe has been a huge part of my life since I was 10 years old. The toys, the cartoons, and the comics. And dang it, I just want to talk about G.I. Joe. That's it. That's my only agenda. And that's why I'm doing another G.I. Joe podcast. I'm going to be reading and talking about G.I. Joe, A Real American Hero, the comic that first began publishing through Marvel Comics in 1982. Before we do, however, I wanted to use this 0 episode to tell you all about who I am and also give a bit of history for folks who want the context behind how G.I. Joe went from shelves to comic racks. So, yeah. How about first, we talk about me? So if you've listened to any of my other shows before, then you might already know this. But if you haven't, here's the speech that I've prepared. I began podcasting in 2006, wandered away in 2008, came back in 2018, and somehow I'm still going strong. Well, I'm hanging in there. I'm also neurodivergent, and that definitely will rear its head from time to time on the show. For example, as I'm editing episodes, I will often hear myself say something that triggers a line from a movie or a TV show, and then it bounces around in my head until something else I say triggers another line. And before I know it, there's like this little chorus of pop culture echoes just knocking around in my skull. And for a long time, I ignored all that chaos while I was editing my episodes. But over the last couple of years, I've kind of given up and I've decided to embrace it. In other words, a few times throughout an episode, I will drop short sound clips into the show. You know, quotes from a movie or a TV show. And I do it not just to satisfy my own neurotic tendencies, but to also give you a little peek into this cobweb factory that I call my brain.
My mind is a raging torrent, flooded with rivulets of thought cascading into a waterfall of creative alternatives.
See, just like that. I should also confess that I am not a G.I. Joe encyclopedia. I know what I owned as a kid, what I watched, and what I read throughout the 80s, but I'm not trying to be a collector's guide or to even recount every issue and reboot across the decades. My comfort zone is the 80s toy line, the cartoons that I grew up with, and the original Marvel comics. So when I say we're starting at the beginning, I mean we're starting with what mattered to me as a kid, the early 80s G.I. Joe universe, mainly the comics, and maybe a little bit of the toys and the cartoon as well.
Hey, bacteria brain, come down and let's discuss your future as a mental patient.
And with that said, how about a bit of history on G.I. Joe? Before we dive straight into the Kung Fu Grip 3¼-inch file card collecting glory of 1980s G.I. Joe, we need to take a step back. And I mean way back, because the story of America's favorite plastic commando doesn't begin in the 80s, or the 70s, or even the 60s. It starts, surprisingly, all the way back in the 1920s with textiles.
Wait, what?
Yeah, textiles. Let me explain. Hasbro began life in 1923 as Hassenfeld Brothers, founded by three Rhode Island brothers, Herman, Hillel, and Henry. They sold leftover fabric. That was it. No lasers, no ninjas, and no exotic vehicles with names like the Dragonfly. Just fabric scraps. But as the decades rolled on, the brothers pivoted, first to pencil cases and school supplies, and then by the 1940s, to toys. In 1952, Hasbro purchased Mr. Potato Head from George Lerner, and it quickly became their first popular toy. But then came 1964, when Hasbro released G.I. Joe, America's Movable Fighting Man. See, back then, in the mid-60s, there was this ignorant belief that boys shouldn't play with dolls like Barbie. Otherwise, they might just suddenly and spontaneously become gay.
What's my boy doing with the Barbie?
I know it's ridiculous, but to solve this non-issue, Hasbro introduced the world to G.I. Joe, a 12-inch, highly articulated doll marketed as an action figure, or, in other words, a doll for boys.
G.I. Joe? Cool. Can I play?
But unlike the G.I. Joe toys that I grew up playing with, the original Joe was just one guy. He dressed in military attire, he was armed with a variety of accessories such as guns, helmets, and canteens, and he came in four different forms. The action soldier, the action sailor, the action pilot, and the action marine. While G.I. Joe was a hit right out of the gate, by the mid-70s, with the Vietnam War reshaping attitudes about military imagery, and with oil prices making plastic toys much more expensive to manufacture, Joe's popularity waned, and by 1976, Hasbro put him to bed.
Go to bed!
As the 80s dawned, however, with Star Wars action figures, vehicles, and playsets selling like hotcakes, Hasbro wanted a piece of that action, and they felt it was time to bring America's Movable Fighting Man out of retirement, but this time with a new and exciting approach. Unfortunately, they just weren't sure how that new approach would look. It was a chance meeting between Hasbro CEO Steven Hassenfeld and the president of Marvel Comics, Jim Galton, at a charity event in 1981 that this new version of G.I. Joe would begin to take shape. Rumor has it that the two met in the restroom where they struck up a conversation, which eventually evolved into the topic of Hasbro's plan to bring back G.I. Joe and the troubles they were facing in regard to exactly how they were going to do it. The Marvel guy, Jim Galton, probably seeing an opportunity to add more stacks of cash to his Scrooge McDuck-inspired money bin, offered the services of Marvel Comics. After all, they weren't called the House of Ideas for nothing.
Every idea is a good idea.
And so, before the night ends, Galton convinces Hassenfeld to let his people take a crack at their G.I. Joe problem. A few days later, Jim Galton meets with the Hasbro execs, and he brings Jim Shooter along with him. Jim Shooter was Marvel's editor-in-chief at the time, and he and Galton sat down with the Hasbro execs, and they started to hammer out a few ideas. Now, Hasbro, going into this meeting, they already had a few of the big-picture decisions already made. They were keenly aware that they needed to do more than produce toys based on just that one guy. In order to make more bang for their buck, they needed a slew of other characters that would fight alongside G.I. Joe. They also needed a group of bad guys for Joe and his team to fight. And they needed a big bunch of vehicles and playsets. The more toys they could produce, the more money they could make. In fact, according to Jim Shooter, at some point during the meeting when the idea of other characters came up, one of the Hasbro execs had asked the question,
"So besides G.I. Joe, do we have G.I. George? G.I. Fred?"
It's at that point, again, according to Jim Shooter, that he suggested the idea that G.I. Joe could be the name of the team rather than the name of one of the guys on the team. And furthermore, this team could be an anti-terrorist group. Hasbro liked the idea, and so Galton and Shooter went back to the Marvel offices, and Shooter set about trying to find a writer for the project. He needed someone with talent, obviously, but also someone willing to take on the job of creating the concept behind this anti-terrorist group, codenamed G.I. Joe, and to basically create everything from scratch and write up the pitch for an ongoing comic book. The problem, however, was that none of the Marvel writers wanted anything to do with the project. Comic books based on toys, well, at the time they were considered by the creative types as the bottom of the comic book barrel, and nobody had any interest at all at putting their name on the book. Now, that was until Jim Shooter got to Larry Hama. That is depending on who you believe. Larry claims that Shooter only brought the project to him after everyone else turned it down. Jim Shooter, however, he tells a different version. According to a blog post, The Secret Parts of the Origin of G.I. Joe, which Jim Shooter wrote and posted to his blog, jimshooter.com, he states that following his initial meeting with Hasbro, and I quote,
"Back at Marvel, I went straight to Larry's office. He, with his military background, was the obvious choice to do the heavy lifting. I told him what happened. He thought, and I agreed, that much of what he'd already cooked up for Nick Fury could be adapted to the project."
Larry's background, by the way, is unreal. Born in 1949, artist at DC, later editor at Marvel, Vietnam veteran, ordnance expert, underground tunnel specialist. I mean, basically, he was a real-life combination of several Joe specialties. Plus, as Jim Shooter had mentioned, he'd already written a pitch called Fury Force, about an elite special missions team led by Nick Fury's son, which Marvel never used. In other words, Larry Hama already had the blueprint. Now, regardless of which version you believe, there is no denying that bringing Larry Hama on board was the key to making it all work. I mean, Jim Shooter had come up with the idea that G.I. Joe should be the name of the team, a daring, highly trained special mission force. And Archie Goodwin, a Marvel editor at the time, well, he came up with the idea behind G.I. Joe's most hated enemy, Cobra Commander and Cobra, the ruthless terrorist organization determined to rule the world. But it was Larry Hama who came up with everything else, such as the names for all the characters and vehicles that would appear in the first wave of the toy line. But more than that, Hama wrote up the brief character biographies that would be used on the file cards that were printed on the back of each of the action figures' packaging. The action figures themselves would be 3¾ inches tall, rather than the original 12-inch size, due to the success of the Star Wars action figure line that was the same size. Another thing Star Wars brought to toys was this idea of story. Kids could get their action figures and play out the scenes from the movies, or just make up their own scenes because they knew how the characters would interact with each other, what their foibles were, their hopes, their dreams, and all of their funny little quirks. Well, that's what the Marvel comic brought to G.I. Joe. Kids would read the comics and then know how to play with their toys.
Now we know.
And knowing is half the battle.
G.I. Joe!
But what made these comics even more special were the TV commercials. At the time, there were strict regulations in place when it came to TV commercials for toys. For example, commercials for toys could only be aired at a certain time. And there were time restrictions regarding how long in each commercial they were allowed to show the toy in animated form versus the actual toy. Commercials for comic books, however, had no such regulations in place. And so the advertising campaign at first focused on the comics. And it worked, too. While I didn't start reading the comics until 1984 with issue number 25, those commercials had me grabbing toys off the shelves in 1982 like a kid possessed.
And now it's mine, all mine.
So there you have it, the origins of G.I. Joe, a real American hero. From textile remnants to a 12-inch military figure to retirement to Marvel Comics to Larry Hama building a universe to one of the most iconic toy lines in American history. But guess what, folks? I am not done. Before we wrap things up, let's first talk about everything that happened after the day that G.I. Joe, a real American hero, number one, hit the stands.
She's been kidnapped by Cobra. We have no alternative. Call in G.I. Joe.
We'll fight for freedom wherever there's trouble. G.I. Joe is there. He never gives up. He'll stay till the fight's won. G.I. Joe.
Who's leader of the Joe team? Hawk.
He's America's best. He's in control. He's a man.
Good luck, Joe.
Oh,
the legend of G.I. Joe, news from Marvel Comics.
G.I. Joe, a real American hero, number one, was published by Marvel Comics on March 2nd, 1982. And for a while, nobody seemed to care. I mean, comic book readers at the time dismissed the series as nothing more than a lowly toy book. But then something rather interesting happened. According to the book, Out of the Garden, Toys, TV, and Children's Culture in the Age of Marketing by Stephen Klein, A few months after the launch of the toy line in 1982, quote,
some 20% of boys from ages 5 to 12 had two or more G.I. Joe toys.
But by 1989, the Complete Encyclopedia to G.I. Joe by Vincent Santelmo tells us that, quote,
two out of every three boys between the ages of 5 and 11 owned at least one G.I. Joe figure.
In other words, what starts to happen is that these kids were loving the toys. And through that love, and through those toys, they discovered the comic series. And by 1985, G.I. Joe, A Real American Hero, was Marvel's highest-selling subscription comic. And I was one of those subscribers. In fact, G.I. Joe, A Real American Hero, is commonly known by comic fans of my age group as a gateway comic. Meaning, for many of us, G.I. Joe was the first book we bought and read monthly, and that got us interested in other comics. And before you know it, we have all practically run out of places to store our massive collections. Also in 1985, Marvel began the publication of G.I. Joe's first spin-off series, the G.I. Joe Yearbook. This was an annual comic, and according to the blurb on the first issue's cover, the book contained everything you need to know about America's favorite heroes. The G.I. Joe Yearbook ran for four issues, ending in 1988. June of 1986 saw the publication of a second ongoing series, G.I. Joe Special Missions, which told stories that were a bit more mature, a bit more violent, and had the Joes facing off against bad guys who were not Cobra. G.I. Joe Special Missions ran for 28 issues, ending in August of 1989. Another G.I. Joe podcast will return after these messages. Step into the savage world of the Hyborian Age and journey through a land of sorcery, steel, and epic adventure with me, Stephen Orr, on Hither Came Conan. Together, we'll explore the legendary Conan the Barbarian comic series from Marvel Comics, starting with the groundbreaking first issue from 1970 and working our way through each epic tale, one issue at a time. Along the way, I'll also dive into any other Conan comics I can get my hands on. Because when it comes to the titular Sumerian, there's no such thing as too much adventure. Whether you're a diehard Conan fan or just discovering the greatest barbarian of all time, this podcast is your gateway to the blood-soaked battlefields, treacherous kingdoms, and forgotten treasures of Robert E. Howard's timeless creation. New episodes are packed with action, insights, and a little humor, all dedicated to the world of Conan and the creators who brought him to life on the comic book page. So sharpen your swords and subscribe to Hither Came Conan today on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts. Crom demands it.
Remember, remember, the 5th of November.
The gunpowder treason and plot.
For I know of no reason why the gunpowder treason should ever be forgot.
Coming soon to the Magazines and Monsters podcast feed.
A deep dive into one of the best works of Alan Moore's career.
Join me, Billy D., and my co-host, Dr. Ange, as we explore the incredible series,
V for Vendetta.
And now back to another G.I. Joe podcast. In August of 86, we got the first of four issues called G.I. Joe Order of Battle, which was the G.I. Joe version of the official handbook of the Marvel Universe, meaning that it contained profiles on all the Joes and all of Cobra, along with their vehicles and even their equipment. Then, in September of 89, we got the first of another four-issue series called G.I. Joe and the Transformers, in which the Joes team up with the Autobots to stop the Decepticons, who have joined forces with
Cobra!
Oh, it's Cobra.
Oh, of course. Look, they have the pictures of the snakes on their planes.
But eventually, all good things must come to an end. And despite the fact that the G.I. Joe comic lasted six times longer than most other toy tie-in comics, by the early 90s, the book dipped in sales, primarily due to the fact that, I mean, it just wasn't all that good anymore. I mean, This is when the image era was taking off, and everything had to be extreme and flashy. Don't get me wrong, there were still a lot of great comics in the 90s, but Marvel and DC completely caved under the pressure and tried their best to emulate those image books by focusing on the art over the story. The problem, however, was that most of the quality artists who worked in the same vein as the Image founders, well, they went to work for Image. So many of the artists that Marvel and DC could find that could ape that style, well, they just weren't very good. And books like G.I. Joe began to suffer because of it. Again, I'm not trying to make any sweeping declarations. Marvel and DC were still producing some good content at the time, just not as much as they were before the Image 7 jumped ship. Anyway, by 1994, G.I. Joe, a real American hero, was canceled due to low sales, ending with issue 155 in October. And yet, Marvel wasn't quite done with the license. In February of 1995, Marvel released their final G.I. Joe issue, G.I. Joe Special No. 1, which was a reprint of G.I. Joe, a Real American Hero No. 61, and frankly, it's got a pretty interesting story around it. See, it seems that Todd McFarlane, before he was Todd McFarlane, provided the pencils for issues 60 and 61. Marvel, while accepting his art for issue 60, found his pencils for issue 61 to be, well, not quite up to their standards. And so, instead, they gave the art chores for issue number 61 to Marshall Rogers. Now, this was early 1987, and while Todd McFarlane was turning heads over on The Incredible Hulk, he wouldn't really start making a name for himself until he began penciling The Amazing Spider-Man later that year in November. Well, by 1994, as Marvel began making plans to publish G.I. Joe Special No. 1, Todd McFarlane was a genuine superstar. And so Marvel made the decision to reprint issue 61, but with McFarlane's pencils rather than the art of Marshall Rogers, which, yeah, I don't know about you, but that sounds like a good old-fashioned cash grab to me. You know, try and get one last big payout before losing the license. Be that as it may, G.I. Joe Special No. 1, which hit the stands on February 1st, 1995, was the final G.I. Joe comic to be published by Marvel Comics.
That's the problem, though. It isn't their loss, it's the kids' loss.
Then in 1996, Hasbro relaunched the G.I. Joe toy line as G.I. Joe Extreme. This new line was set in the then future of 2009, and it didn't use any of the characters that Larry Hama had created for the Real American Hero line. With the launch of G.I. Joe Extreme, the comic license made its way to Dark Horse Comics, who published a total of 8 issues based on the new toy line. In 1999, the license then moved on and went to Bench Press Comics, who had not only planned to publish 2 new titles, they were going to involve Larry Hama as well. However, everything sort of blew apart when the negotiations with Larry Hama stalled and Bench Press went broke. The license then went to Devil's Due in 2001, who first published a 4-issue limited series called G.I. Joe Reinstated. That was written by Josh Blaylock, and it featured the art of John Larder and Stephen Kearse. The 4 issues sold well enough that the decision was made to take it from a limited to an ongoing series. Now, G.I. Joe Reinstated is often referred to by fans as G.I. Joe, A Real American Hero, Volume 2, because the series takes up the Marvel storyline just 7 years later. At the time, Devil's Due had been publishing the series through Image Comics. But by issue 26, Devil's Due had become their own publishing company and began releasing the books themselves. The series lasted a total of 43 issues, before being relaunched under the title G.I. Joe America's Elite. This series ran for 36 issues. Along with the main series, Devil's Due also released G.I. Joe Battle Files in 2002, a 3-issue miniseries that gave profiles of the G.I. Joe and Cobra teams, as well as information on their vehicles. I haven't read these, but sounds a lot like Marvel's Order of Battle, just 3 issues instead of 4. Also in 2002, Devil's Due published 18 issues of a series called G.I. Joe Frontline, which contained the 4-part story, The Mission That Never Was, which was written by Larry Hama and is set 1 month after the events of issue number 155, from the Marvel series. In 2004, Devils Due released the first of a four-issue series called G.I. Joe, Master and Apprentice, which featured the origin of Kamu Kara. And in 2005, they launched G.I. Joe, Master and Apprentice Volume 2, which featured Storm Shadow's apprentice, Junko Akita, and was also four issues. Also in 2004, they published G.I. Joe Reloaded, which lasted 14 issues and featured an all-new continuity. In 2005, they published the six-issue series Snake Eyes Declassified, as well as the six-issue limited series G.I. Joe Sigma 6, based on the cartoon of the same name. In 2006, they began publication of a three-issue bi-monthly series called G.I. Joe Declassified, along with the one-shot Scarlet Declassified. From 2006 to 2007, Devils Due published six issues of G.I. Joe Special Missions, which was a series of 48-page specials that spotlighted missions involving various G.I. Joe personnel. And they also released Dreadnoughts Declassified, which was a three-issue bi-monthly series featuring the origin of Zartan and the Dreadnoughts. Storm Shadow got his own series in 2007, which was written by Larry Hama and lasted seven issues. And between 2003 and 2007, Devils Due released four different limited series that brought G.I. Joe together with the Transformers. But in January of 2008, the G.I. Joe license expired, and Hasbro decided not to renew it, ending their relationship with Devils Due.
That's so sad.
On May 29th of that same year, the official announcement went out that the license had been given to IDW, who began their G.I. Joe journey by ignoring the past continuity that began with the Real American Hero at Marvel and continued at Devils Due. Instead, they chose to focus on new stories and a new continuity, launching the Joe content with three titles: G.I. Joe, G.I. Joe Origins, and G.I. Joe Cobra. G.I. Joe, the main series, began with a zero issue in October of 2008 and ran for 27 more issues, ending in February of 2011. IDW went on to publish other G.I. Joe titles like G.I. Joe Cobra 2, G.I. Joe Hearts and Minds, G.I. Joe Infestation, and so much more. But then something special happened. In July of 2010, IDW published G.I. Joe, A Real American Hero, number 156, which not only took up the story directly from where it left off with issue number 155 that Marvel published all the way back in October of 1994, but it also brought Larry Hama back as the series writer. All right, okay, but hold on a second. What about those 79 issues that Devils Due published that took up the Real American Hero storyline 7 years after the events in issue 155?
What's up with that?
Well, when IDW began their publication of A Real American Hero, Hasbro announced that the Devils Due continuity was no longer canonical. And I quote,
"Fans can read it according to their personal preference, but we are currently taking the brand in a direction that does not take the Devils Due story into account."
IDW continued publishing A Real American Hero until November of 2022 with issue number 300. After that, in June of 2023, Hasbro announced that Skybound Entertainment, Robert Kirkman's imprint published through Image Comics, had acquired the license for both G.I. Joe and the Transformers, and as of the release date of this episode, they still hold them today. Now, what's interesting with Skybound's approach is what they did with these properties. First, they created an all-new continuity with the birth of the Energon universe, a shared universe in which G.I. Joe and the Transformers dwell together. Within the Energon universe were four limited series titles: Duke, Cobra Commander, Scarlet, and Destro. These four titles set up the introduction of the new G.I. Joe series that incorporated the Cybertronian technology of the Transformers with Cobra weapons and such. Now, I'm way behind on the series, but I have read each of the four limited series, and I'm just a few issues into the main series, and it's a lot of fun. I do recommend it to anyone who has yet to partake. But beyond the Energon universe, Skybound also brought over G.I. Joe, A Real American Hero, launching it with issue number 301 on November 15th, 2023, and of course, they brought Larry Hama on board to continue the story he started over at Marvel, all the way back in 1982.
1982?
Yes. And that, folks, is where the G.I. Joe comic book franchise sits at this very moment in time. Or at least the very moment in time that this episode was published. If you're listening to this for the first time in 2042, well, I mean, there's no telling what state the franchise might be in. But with all that said, I have one last bit here before we go, and I'm calling it the G.I. Joe Fun Facts bit. Fun fact number one, Marvel's G.I. Joe, A Real American Hero, was not the first G.I. Joe comic ever published. According to Wikipedia, there have been G.I. Joe comic books published from 1967 to the present, with only two interruptions that were longer than a year, 1977 to 1981 and 1997 to the year 2000. In 1967, Hasbro released a single small comic book with its action figures titled America's Movable Fighting Man, which was published by Custom Comics, Inc., an imprint of American Comics Group, and it featured illustrations by Kurt Schaffenberger. In 1969, issues of a larger format comic with more elaborate stories were released with the toys as The Adventures of G.I. Joe. From 1970 to 1976, Hasbro continued to reprint and publish new comics in-house as the G.I. Joe Adventure Team. And then between 1975 and 1976, Hasbro published comic book advertisements starring the Adventure Team, featuring the original G.I. Joe, Atomic Man, and Bullet Man as members. Fun fact number two, G.I. Joe, A Real American Hero, is known in Finland, Sweden, and the UK under the title Action Force. Fun fact number three, Marvel's G.I. Joe European missions were reprints of Action Force Monthly. From May of 1988 to August of 1989, Marvel published a monthly series called G.I. Joe European Missions, and each issue was a reprint of Action Force Monthly, a title that was published in the UK that contained all original G.I. Joe stories that, until the publication of European Missions, were never before seen in the U.S. And that's it, folks. That is everything I know about the publishing history of G.I. Joe comics. What about you? Did I miss something? Did I get something wrong? Or do you have your own G.I. Joe fun facts that you would just like to share? Email me at stephenorelse@gmail.com, and who knows? Maybe I'll read it out on a future episode. In our next episode, Dr. Adele Burkhart, America's top nuclear physicist, is abducted by Cobra, and G.I. Joe is called in to bring her back. But what's all this about Dr. Burkhart being a traitor? That's coming up on episode one as we take a great long look at G.I. Joe, A Real American Hero, number one, Operation Lady Doomsday, which was published by Marvel Comics in March of 1982. So until then, folks, I'm Steven, and this has been another G.I. Joe podcast. Thanks for listening. Bye.
I want to thank you for listening to this episode of another G.I. Joe podcast. Questions and comments can be directed to StephenOrElse@gmail.com. If you enjoyed the show, you can help to boost our presence online by leaving a rating or review on your favorite podcast app. I also invite you to join our subscription program, Stephen or Else Beyond. And in return, you'll get episodes of another G.I. Joe podcast early and ad-free. Check out the link in the show notes or just go to beyond.stephenorelse.com to sign up today. Another G.I. Joe podcast is a presentation of Stephen or Else Media. For more nerdy content hosted by me, check out somanypodcasts.com. All links will be in the show notes.
But before we jump into the comic books themselves, I wanted to use this Zero episode here to tell you a little bit about who I am. And also, I wanted to use this Zero episode here to tell you all... Bah! I wanted to use this Zero episode to pinch my face with a slap in the boot. Hasbro liked the idea, and so Galton and Shooter went back to the Marvel offices, and Shooter set about the task to Hasbro liked the idea, and so Galton and Shooter went back to the Marvel. Jesus, fuck.
I just don't think I can move through life knowing that a guy named Steven did this to me.
How could you let this happen, Steven?
Steven, thank God. I had a horrible feeling I was going to be the only one here.
You were saying
G.I. Joe.